These messages, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener commentary.
KBOO Community Radio wants to hear from you, our dear listeners and members, about why you support KBOO, why you listen, and why others should support the radio station. Please call 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us your name, what KBOO means to you, and why do you continue to support KBOO. Again, that's 503-231-8032, extension 302. Thank you for supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
Hey, good morning. It's
what is it? Tell us.
It's hurricane season.
Yeah,
in a big way, and it's a lot of it worse than usual because of climate change.
Oh, okay. And we're less prepared than usual
because we have
for
this
all
idiot
the usual reasons. Yeah.
Hey,
okay.
If you don't want to hear us dump on Trump, you probably should listen to some kind of rock and roll or something.
Right. I can't even guarantee that'll be a dump-free zone either.
No, I mean, it's gotten so bad. Okay, this is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor and me, Joe Uris, 231-8187. We are not being biased. We're being accurate.
Yeah, we're being accurate.
Yeah.
We do open ourselves to charges of obsessing over the Commander-in-Chief.
How can you not obsess over the murderous...
Yeah, I would agree.
The
yeah.
murderous SOB.
If you have even one eye open... it's hard not to be...
If you have a nostril open, it's hard not to catch the smell.
This is very true. Yeah, pick your sensory organ.
Well,
yeah,
let's not go
hard
too
not to
far
register.
Here.
Yeah, it's... Things are not good.
No,
things are
not
good, and they're heading in a distinctly troubling direction. Of course, this is not news
no.
to anyone who's paying attention, but we want to get into some of the more recent details that have us alarmed.
Right, and we really do... I can't say for you, but I really do believe that we have a mafioso as our president.
Yes, we do, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I have a perfect example of that.
Go for it.
That's a really interesting and, I think, really apt characterization.
We have not talked about this.
No, we have not. If Trump behaves, he speaks in many ways almost like a stereotypical mob boss
yeah.
in many ways. Here's a perfect example.
Pardon me.
The vice president, Mike Pence.
Mike Pence, who has a mother for a wife. He says mother.
Oh, well, I presume he has a mother.
I presume he has a mother.
Okay, well, that's neither here
nor there. Let's not go into the incest world.
He's in Ireland
yes.
right now.
Yes. Mike Pence is in Ireland?
He's in Ireland right now, yeah.
Sure, and they love him.
Yeah, sure they do. He's been taking meetings with the Irish prime minister, which is probably very difficult for Mr. Pence because the Irish prime minister is gay.
Yes.
So I think Pence probably has to have some extra men in the room just to, I don't know. He does. Whatever precautions he's taking them.
Aaron go gay?
Yeah. All right. Here's why this is interesting, and here's how it plays into the characterization of Trump as a mob boss. Pence is not staying in Dublin, where his meetings are.
Why not?
Because he's staying more than an hour's flight away to the west at a property owned by Donald Trump.
I'm so shocked.
Yeah. So this is, if you're keeping score at home, yet another violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause.
Right.
Because Trump is profiting now from an official
so they moved
state
the whole,
visit.
They may move the whole shemang-a-bang with all the...
No. They just moved Pence.
Just Pence.
He's flying back and forth.
All the time?
Yes, between Dublin and this place where Trump's property where he's staying.
Yeah, but it's so nice.
I have no idea. Probably not. But let's get to that a little bit later.
Okay.
So he's staying there. And of course, he's received some pushback about this. And the Pence's spokesperson is saying, no, Trump didn't tell Pence to stay there or command him to stay there. He merely suggested.
Right.
Here's a quote from Pence's spokesperson, a guy named Mark Short. He told this to NBC News. I don't think it was a request or like a command. I think it was a suggestion. Is there anything more mob bossy than that? Trump just saying something like, yeah, you know maybe
it'd be
you
good,
should stay
yeah.
at my place when you're in Ireland.
Yeah, you know, it'd be a good thing. You don't want to go
yeah.
somewhere else, do
yeah.
you?
No, it'd make me very happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
all the stereotypes are there.
All the stereotypes are there. So this is interesting, though. Tell me why you equated him to a mob boss, because I have some thoughts on this.
Well, first of all, he has had relationships with, business relationships with, emotional relationships with actual, real, identified, and even prosecuted mobsters.
So you're saying he's like a mob boss because he's done business with the mob? Oh, come on.
Well, I'm saying he's like a mob boss because he not only does business with the mob, but does business with the mob.
I think you're exactly right. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Okay.
Yeah, and why else?
Well, because his style is imperious.
Yes.
And it's in the style of, I can't think of anything except during Cecil B. DeMille's remake of The Ten Commandments, where the Pharaoh says, "So I have said, let it be done."
Ah.
That's it.
So
that's enough.
He's like a mob boss and an ancient Egyptian king.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, never mind.
Yeah. Well, you're right. Yeah, he has actual business ties to the mob.
Yeah.
He hides money all over the place, much like people in organized crime do. He employs a number of strongmen, enforcers, to go around imposing his will.
Yes.
Mr. Cohen being probably the most prominent of them.
Poor Mr. Cohen. And he said himself, and this is important, "Where's my Roy Cohen?" Roy Cohen, though many of you may be too young to know this, was the archetypal creepy right-wing mobby guy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so, very much like an organized crime figure, our president.
Oh, I think so.
And I'm going to hazard a guess that that's not what most people typically look for in a president.
Well, it depends on who you are.
Yeah. All right, so this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the president. We're going to be talking about more danger signs on the horizon, both near and far.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So go ahead, Joe. What you got?
Well, I got an article in today's. What does Trump call the New York Times?
The failing New York Times?
The failing New York Times. Yeah, the failing New York Times has an article by a very successful Paul Krugman, economist, who talks about this tax break.
Yeah, he's just a Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah, just a Nobel Prize winner. What does that mean? You know, anyway, he talks about how essentially we all got ripped off in this tax hike, that nothing about it is helpful to ordinary people or poor people. The first thing is there's supposed to be some kind of trickle-down thing happening, not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's supposed to be some benefits to ordinary people, not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the final thing is the tax breaks are really about the rich, only the rich.
Always.
Always.
Always and forever.
Yeah.
That's what it has always been. If you're not reading Krugman on a regular basis, I really recommend that you do for a couple of reasons.
He's online.
Yeah. He's online, yeah. You don't have to get the Dead Tree version of the Times to get it. His column.
Yeah, I get the Dead Tree version.
Yeah. But
that's me.
That is you.
And yes.
We won't talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. Because we'll get mad at each other.
There's a number of reasons why it's a good idea to read Krugman on a regular basis. First, he has a comprehensive grasp of the economic issues at play.
Yeah.
And he presents them in a way that lay people can grasp and understand.
Yeah.
Secondly, he is very good at encapsulating the overall strategy of the right over a long period of time, and a way of framing that again in a way that's it's quite easy to understand.
Yes.
And thirdly, he has managed his business, especially in the last several months of his column. He has been able to establish Trump and his followers and his movement in the context of a much larger global movement, which Krugman characterizes as right-wing authoritarianism versus everybody else.
And we're seeing it all over.
All over the world, yeah. So he's making a very important observation, which I think everybody ought to take note of, which is what's going on here is simply a piece of a much larger struggle going on all over the world.
And with the leader similar, of it. With the leader of it.
With similar overtones at play. So all these things are very important, and they're all reasons why everybody should be reading Paul Crutcher.
So in long and the short of it, if you don't want to hear bad stuff about this government at this time, you should listen to MSNBC. No, that wouldn't work either. Or how about CNN? No, that wouldn't work either.
No.
I don't know.
I'm sure if you looked far enough, you'd find something.
Oh, but it's not even, apparently, it's not even Fox News. Because Trump is mad at Fox News. They don't play the line.
Yeah, apparently not quite fawning enough.
What are you going to do? Okay, hey, we got people calling us. So, 231-8187. Jeremy, you're the first person online.
Thank you.
Sure.
So, I went to a prep school in New York City called Horace Mann. And, we have a graduate. We have many hideously illustrious graduates. But some people consider Roy Cohen to be Donald Trump's mentor. He of course went to Horace Mann. So did Elliot Spitzer and a few other reprobates. Anyway, I'm preparing for my reunion where I will be regaled with, you know, they're happily famous graduates, but I always am interested in the bad ones.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, because Trump did a fair amount of business with Cohen, although Cohen was driving around in a $100,000 purple Rolls Royce, picking up
purple a purple Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He was covered in Sarkozy's sarcoma lesions. Mm-hmm. He was obviously dying, and he was, I believe, some people think intentionally spreading AIDS to the 14-year-old Puerto Rican hookers that he preferred.
Well, I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I do know that he did die of AIDS.
I'm sorry? He died of Kaposi's sarcoma.
Well, he's dead. And I am not super knowledgeable about his personal life. And almost anything bad said about him probably is true, but I don't know that it's true. And it kind of makes me uneasy to attack someone for doing something really horrible when there's nobody to defend.
No one would consider it an attack. It's a reported, documented fact.
Okay.
And the reason it's interesting, in a horrific grand genial way, is that during his entire life, I think he never admitted that he was gay. He was sort of macho.
I think one of the things I really would like to knock down is the notion that homosexuals are not or cannot be macho. That's silly.
Yeah, I agree. But, I think he probably died in the mid-80s. So it was a different culture. And around all that. Anyway, the most interesting of our graduates, it was Allard Lowenstein, another closeted homosexual who was murdered by one of the people that he had groped. Anyway,
why are you focused on this?
Oh, I'm getting ready for my 50th reunion, and we had a
that
huge
explains
sex
it.
Scandal. Yes, and we had a huge sex scandal over the last few years, where there were like 30 named perpetrators, 100 victims, and New York City finally changed their laws about reporting, so it's going to blow up in the news again. They did a pretty, you know. I mean, there have been sex scandals all over the place.
Listen,
you know,
I'm going to have to interrupt you. I wish you luck. I wish you luck on your reunion. But I want to give some other people an opportunity.
Okay, I think we should take this opportunity to point out a distinction between two distinct people. One is Roy Cohn.
Right.
Right, the famous right-wing fixer, mob-like figure.
McCarthy's best friend.
Right. The other, Michael Cohen,
right,
Trump's attorney,
exactly,
who, as we know, sang like a canary,
right,
during the Mueller investigation.
And I actually think that it's incidental and significant in some ways, but really not politically that important about the issue about homosexuality. It's a kind of a fecal matter in the punch bowl, the way it's presented.
Right. Right.
I don't like that.
503-231-8187. I want to touch on a theme that we talked about just a second ago, and that is this this global rise of authoritarianism happening.
Yeah,
all over
I think
the world.
That's really where our focus needs to be.
I think it is, and in enmeshed in this, I think is an irony of enormous proportions.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to point that out. Okay, so what? Why are right-wing authoritarian governments on the rise over the world? What's the short answer there, Joe?
I won't answer.
Okay, because citizens are largely reacting to economic pressures, expressing xenophobia, and expressing racism.
Yeah, I think the last one, expressing racism, is very revealing.
Yeah. The fact is that global capitalism, as it becomes ever broader, ever more encompassing of the global economy, and ever more proficient in its ability to seek out cheaper labor all over the world.
Right.
This is undercutting the ability of workers wherever
anywhere
they happen to be,
including here,
to make a decent living. Now, there are workers that are protected to a certain degree in some of the social democracies in Europe, by way of example. Also in places like Japan, places like South Korea, and so on. But even those protections that they have traditionally enjoyed are proving to be tenuous in the face of this overwhelming downward pressure on wages.
And I want to point out that the once powerful organized labor movement in the United States, beginning in the 1930s into the 1950s and 60s, is no longer that powerful.
No.
And that means that though there's plenty of people working, as Trump loves to say, the fact of the matter is they're not earning the kind of money they would be earning if you followed the curve of wages and everybody was in organized labor.
Yeah. And when economic pressures are dialed up like this, the elite, the ruling class, through its mouthpieces of members of representative democracies around the world, start pointing fingers at whom to blame. And usually those fingers are pointed at people who, at immigrants, at members of marginalized communities, and so on. Mm-hmm. And this vicious circle is exacerbated by the fact that we are seeing right now, at this moment in time, nearly unprecedented numbers of refugees and immigrants in places all around the world for a number of reasons. First, people in Europe fleeing the unrest in the Middle East, particularly in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also beginning to see more and more large numbers of climate-related refugees. We're seeing that right here in the United States.
Well, we're going to see much more of that.
Much more of that in the years and the decades to come. People, for example, fleeing what has become almost a new desert zone in parts of Guatemala and Honduras, places where it used to rain a lot but hardly rains anymore.
Right.
This is one of a consequence, of course, of global climate change. Folks are being displaced. They're leaving. They're obviously seeking out opportunities in places where they think they can be found, like wealthy countries like the United States. So, as I mentioned, this creates sort of a vicious feedback loop wherein things get worse. There's more and more downward pressure on wages because of the excesses of the global capitalist elite. Fingers are pointed at people who are fleeing the consequences of the actions of the global capitalist elite. And we end up with this rise in right-wing authoritarianism, where workers who ironically should be up in arms at the ownership class are instead up in arms against people they think are coming and stealing their jobs.
Right.
When in fact they should be making common cause with refugees and immigrants against the owners who are grinding them slowly to dust in this global capitalist system.
You know, this is so important and must be understood in petty as well as serious ways. The fact of the matter is I'm hearing from people who regularly employed very well-trained, very skilled workers who happen to be people of color from the South, and that those people are now reluctant to work, reluctant to be noticed in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to get worse. And now we have Trump, and I think he's backing off on this because everybody got so outraged. He was going to kick out all the terminally sick young children that were being treated in hospitals. He's going to kick them out. I mean, it's so inhumane. It's so mean. It's so petty. It's so stupid.
And that's the point. The cruelty is the point.
You're right.
Essentially now, so you ask, who then amongst the great masses of voters, the working classes in all of these Western countries where this rise of authoritarianism is coming from, why are they throwing in their hats with the racists, the xenophobes, so on and so forth? And the answer is because of the racism and the xenophobia. Basically, it's come for the racism, stay for the class envy. That is the appeal.
That was a nice use of language, if I may say so.
Well, thank you very much. That's, you know, why I make so much money here at KBOO.
Yeah, right. We're so well paid.
503-231-8187.
And I'm gonna beg that women who might be reticent to be on the air because there's a kind of bad traditional thing about women in talk radio, I think, call us.
Yeah. And so we get around then to the figure of Donald Trump himself.
Yeah.
Who, again, ironically, is both an aberration and something completely to be expected under the current global conditions that we're looking at.
You're right.
Yeah. It's
he's the logical outcome of late-stage capitalism.
Right. Not, again, well, that phrase, late-stage capitalism, but we'll debate that later. He's really the kind of figure you might expect when conservative voters suddenly vote their racism. He's the kind of figure you might expect. But at the same time, he's so crazy that you got to wonder how a system in any advanced country could throw up a guy like that.
You know, we need to invent a sound effect of cuckoo whenever we name Trump.
No, we got to get better. We got to do better than cuckoo.
Better than cuckoo?
Yeah, there's
what
something
could be better
sure,
than cuckoo.
There's something out there. I bet we can find it.
Okay, and we're getting calls, and we should probably attend to that. But
all right,
do you want to have a little more?
No. We'll expand as we go. But let's talk to Francis. Right
okay,
now.
Francis, you're on the air.
Hi. I am really just kind of like amazed that this story continues and that this man is still in office.
Well, he got elected, sort of.
Right. Well, yeah, but what is our Congress doing? To me, that's where the
Congress, regardless of sex, particularly the Republicans, are whores.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, because that's where the responsibility is to provide oversight to this man who is making a mockery of the presidency.
Yeah.
Literally. Mm-hmm. Literally. And they don't do anything. And to me, the culprit in all of this is the Senate Majority Leader, McConnell. And
you mean the turtle?
But that person... it's sinister. I mean, the legislation that's just sitting on his desk and doesn't go anywhere after it's been passed in the House,
mm-hmm.
The fact that there's no oversight whatsoever, unless they call it the Democrats' oversight, and that to me is, all the news media calls it Democrats are doing this to the president. The Democrats are doing... what about the Congress?
Well, I agree with you, but you know,
why is it made such a political thing all the time? Where the issue is what is right and what is wrong. It's not who's a Democrat and who's a Republican. It's what is being allowed to happen.
Well,
Congress.
In a way, I agree with you. In a way, I don't. I think my theoretical model, my overarching idea, is that we're moving into a thing called late-stage capitalism. And in late-stage capitalism, the representative government is representative only of the ruling class. And that's always...
it's representative of the corporations, which
well,
are
the ruling, people. Yeah, the ruling class. And that has been an issue always. And with great challenges, there have been modifications. For example, the Great Depression and the response, particularly in the Democratic Party with FDR, that change lasted through the Eisenhower administration, and it collapsed. That was the period of time when organized labor was powerful. That was a period of time when workers were really suddenly beginning to benefit out of a situation that was terrifying, the Great Depression. We don't have that kind of power
That's
within the working
kind of
class
representation
anymore.
Representation in Congress anymore. We have a representative of Congress that represents the interests of corporations,
yeah,
and not the people.
Yeah.
And when our people are finally represented again, we won't have this issue. You know, I don't know how we got. I know how it came about that corporations got personhood. But I really, and I've said this before, think that needs to be revisited, because you cannot put a corporation in prison. You cannot. A corporation does not have a conscience, does not have a soul.
But you can't take its money away.
It has short-term profit is what its conscience is. And that's not a person. So I don't know how we're going to get that switched around. But until Congress starts representing the people again, this is what we get.
Well, I think you're right, Francis, and I think we should be talking about that a great deal.
And there are people in Congress who are representing the people, and they're called socialists, like they're something bad.
Well, they're now using old-time red baiting. They're talking about socialists
right.
and communists.
Same old soup. But McConnell is the person that needs to be talked about all day long, as far as I'm concerned, because he's putting a stop in representing the
well,
president.
Well, and you know, he is more than he.
And while this man pretends to be president and plays the game, and sometimes I think he just says stuff just to see how far he can go with.
No, I think he's quite rational, and his wife and he kind of trying to run things. Listen,
no,
I want to thank you
rational.
Very, Francis.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, and I want to go on
all
to
right,
the
you guys
next
take
call.
Care.
Yeah, there's all kinds of problems with this notion of corporate personhood, aren't there?
Yes.
Because if you consider, if you buy that trope, right, corporations are people?
The Supreme Court did.
They did. Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of precedent for that, equating the two. If you buy it, though, you're talking about people who really are more godlike than human, right?
Yeah.
So if corporation is a person, Exxon Corporation is a person. Exxon Corporation that's also functionally immortal, can exist and carry out business and actions in many places simultaneously.
Yes,
and is only limitedly liable for the consequences of its actions.
Kind of like a Hindu god in the old style.
Yeah, very much so. So that might be a good basis from which to evaluate corporate personhood. Do we really want godlike people running around doing unfettered things in our society?
Do we really have any power to stop them?
We only have limited power to rein them in at this moment in time.
Well, let's go out to the phone. 231-8187. Bill, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Really appreciate your show, a longtime listener. Getting back to the mob guy, the godfather of the country at this point, I'm curious as to why the RICO statutes have not been enacted against him and his organizations.
Well,
The easy answer is that no, Trump's attorney general is not going to prosecute him on RICO charges.
And in fact, the Constitution is unclear about whether or not a president can be prosecuted. He can be kicked out, and then prosecuted. But prior to that, it's not clear.
Okay, so in the meantime, we're just at a stalemate, waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah, essentially. Essentially, Trump is unaccountable.
Yeah, he's flying by his own power.
Well, he's been unaccountable his whole life, apparently. So,
that's very true. That's very true, and I think that fact has very much shaped the man he has become.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'm going to get off the phone and open the lines to other callers.
You're so generous.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, Jack has written into the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/AbeandJoe. He writes, "The Don, a crooked businessman, a mob boss, which has been clear from the outset. So what does the party of Pelosi do?"
Oh, dear.
And then he asks the question, will Russiagate take down the Don before we get a full-blown new Cold War? I don't think so.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, things are out of whack to such a degree. I mean, it's weird. We now have a Russia which is, of course, under Stalin and others, not really socialist, but very powerful. Not really communist, but very powerful.
I think fascist is an accurate descriptor
well,
now.
I think we'd have to be honest and call it some kind of new modern fascism. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a totalitarian government with a dictatorial head of state.
Yeah.
That enables essentially a plutocracy and a kleptocracy to function.
Yes, and now with the collapse of all the pose of the Soviet Union. It's clear. It's a clear kleptocracy. It's a clear mafia-like organization that is running this nation that once was extremely powerful and now actually is hurting.
Yeah.
And that the fact that it's hurting has led it, I think, in not just because of that, but in part because of that, into the role of trying to destroy democracies all over the world, not just the United States, but I believe actually the Brexit was largely... to a great extent, not largely, but to a great extent, influenced by the Russians.
Yes, we do. In fact, the influence brought to bear by Russia in the Brexit affair had the same foundation as the influence brought to bear by Russia in the 2016 election here in the United States, which was the absolute treasure trove of behavioral and psychological and sociological information gleaned from Facebook by Cambridge Analytica.
Yes.
We did a show about this.
Yes.
Several months back. A fascinating story that we should probably revisit at some point or another.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes, if you had to ask yourself, well, you know, what context makes the actions of Donald Trump on the international stage make sense? All right, if you ask that, frame that question.
Well, you know, I can't even frame that question.
What frame of reference explains his actions? And pursuing Putin's aims of destabilizing NATO,
mm-hmm.
Even breaking away NATO member countries from the European Union.
Oh, clearly.
And turning a blind eye to Russia's territorial ambitions in the Ukraine. All of these things make sense in terms of explaining Donald Trump's behavior on the international stage. He is fulfilling Putin's objectives.
And he loves totalitarian regimes. He loves kings.
He does. Yeah. Well, I mean, over and over again. It's almost a cliche. In fact,
it is a cliche.
Yeah. And it all plays into what we talked about a little while ago, which is this worldwide rise of authoritarianism, which has been particularly noticeable in the governments of some of the more wealthy countries. I want to quote from an article written by Bernie Sanders. Yes, almost exactly a year ago in The Guardian. Now, we mentioned earlier why it's important to read Paul Krugman. I would also, if those of you interested in good journalism, turn your eyeballs to The Guardian.
You can get it online.
You can get it online. It's a British-based newspaper. They have extensive operations here in the United States. And they've even got a reporter here in Portland who has been writing some really good material on the clashes, ongoing clashes between Antifa and the militant right wing.
Yeah, I want to throw in something about the militant right wing. It's clearly their plan to break the city by showing up and causing the city to spend a fortune on policing.
Yeah, and they're also jerks. I want to make that observation.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so The Guardian, good thing to read. All right, so here's Bernie about a year ago in The Guardian. It should be clear by now that Donald Trump and the right-wing movement that supports him is not a phenomenon unique to the United States. All around the world, in Europe, in Russia, in the Middle East, in Asia, and elsewhere, we are seeing movements led by demagogues who exploit people's fears, prejudices, and grievances to achieve and hold on to power. This trend certainly did not begin with Trump, but there's no question that authoritarian leaders around the world have drawn inspiration from the fact that the leader of the world's oldest and most powerful democracy seems to delight in shattering democratic norms. 3 years ago, who would have imagined that the United States would stay neutral between Canada, our democratic neighbor and second largest trading partner, and Saudi Arabia, a monarchic client state that treats women as third-class citizens?
But never slicing anybody up or anything.
No, no.
Never bombing the Houthis or anything.
No, no. It's also hard to imagine never coordinating a terrorist attack on the United States.
No, they wouldn't do that.
It's also hard to imagine that Israel's Netanyahu government would have moved to pass the recent nation-state law, which essentially codifies the second-class status of Israel's non-Jewish citizens. If Benjamin Netanyahu didn't know, Trump would have his back. This is what happens when you elect a guy like Trump to be the ostensible leader of the free world. It means that authoritarians all over feel that they can do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah, all they have to do is kiss the feet of the boss.
Yep, kiss the feet of the boss. Now we're looking at the almost, even just a few years ago, would have been unthinkable to contemplate that Britain would A, leave the European Union, and B, do so with no plan whatsoever.
It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing.
And then they got this weird guy who looks like Trump
as the
prime minister. Oh, well.
And he's got a Russian first name. It just gets weirder.
It's weird. It's weird. Right. Forget about the Russian first name, though. That's silly.
All right, let's go to George. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for bringing up so many interesting things. I had to call when one of you said, yes, Stalin was a fascist dictator or an evil dictator. And I thought, well
not necessarily a fascist, but a totalitarian dictator. Yes.
I'm sorry, I stand corrected. And I happen to remember that a few years ago, I somehow found an advertisement for a book about the Stalin era,
uh-huh.
written by an American historian who was a medievalist and student of languages and got interested in Soviet Russia. His name is, I believe he's still alive, Grover Furr, F-U-R-R,
uh-huh.
and he read a book by, I think, a guy named Timothy Snyder of Yale. And Snyder went to work on Stalin and wrote a book, I don't know, several hundred pages, saying that Stalin was, and he never missed, apparently, Snyder never missed a chance to say, I have evidence here for this, that Stalin was a mass murdering.
Well, there's no question about that.
Yeah, and, this looked to Furr like something interesting. So Furr got interested in, and he learned how to read Russian, and he started studying this. And he wrote a book saying every one of Snyder's accusations against Stalin was false, based on manipulated evidence or made-up stuff. And I couldn't believe it until I heard it on KABU. Someone mentioned a book by Grover Furr, Blood Lies, L-I-E-S, meaning lies like he's lying.
Right.
And it was published just a few years ago, I think 2010 or maybe 2009, 2014, first corrected edition, July 2014.
Yeah, cut to the chase, man.
Right, and so Furr said that, hey, he went through Snyder's book, where Snyder says Stalin, you know, totally every evil person, did everything evil, and Grover Furr, in this book, Blood Lies, says, I believe, shown that every one of Snyder's claims is false.
Ah, this I do not know about.
Well, I didn't know about it, and I read the advertisement for the book, and I bought the book, and I started it, and I probably read 40 or 50 pages, and I realize I can't read Russian, I'm not an expert, but it looks like Grover Furr believes he has shown that Snyder was not telling us the truth. And I just think I should leave it there, and people should know that Grover Furr, F-U-R-R, his book, Blood Lies, the evidence that every accusation against Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union in Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands is false.
Okay.
Is available. And so I'll just get off.
Okay.
Go ahead,
hey, thanks very much.
That's an interesting idea. I don't want to spend time visiting the Stalinist era. At one point in my life, I was much more enthusiastic, and I have to confess this, about the Soviet Union itself and about its activities. But I have since, I think, come to understand more about what happened, and I am not a happy camper on that respect. And let's who do we have next? Sylvia. Let's put Sylvia on the air. 231-8187. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I practically never call anymore, but I thought in this case I would. I mean, the world is... it's so horrible. It's unbelievable. But I just want to make a comment just on one specific aspect. In the current issue of Street Roots, there is an article, A Plea of Humanity. And it is the chief prosecutor who was in Nuremberg at that time, and he prosecuted the war criminals for all the war crimes and for the crimes against humanity. And in the article, he goes into some detail on what is happening now with Trump, and he's doing exactly the same kinds of things with the immigrants, with the children, etc., etc., etc. And no one seemed... apparently everything that was decided back in 1946 is just simply out the window. Those were the laws, the international laws that came out of the Nazi era. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that.
No, I really appreciate that, and I also want to give a shout out to Street Roots. It's a great publication. When one
oh
of the
my
people,
God, yes.
When people come around with it and they're asking for the buck, give them the buck. Give them $2.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, as a side note, I was born in Nuremberg in 1946.
Ah.
So I have a real thing about the collective unconscious. It stayed with me for all my life, and now I'm 73.
Well,
we haven't learned a thing. We've only learned how to make it worse and be more criminal than possible.
I want to thank you for the call, and I find your own history very interesting. It's something that, you know, that you should really, I'm going to use the word exploit because I can't think of a better one. You should really bring it forth. And And I want to thank you. So sure. I guess 2318187, we got Michael. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
You're leaving out what I think is a very important aspect in, as you talk about what's going on politically in the world,
sure.
which is the urban-rural split, which you see all over the place. We have
no, I think you're right. I hardly ever agree with you, but I think that is a significant factor.
And, you know, one thing about that urban-rural split is those rural people really have a point. They really have grievances that deserve to be taken into account of. And it seems like the main response to them from the mainstream media is to call them racist. And that's gone on to the point where it's like crying wolf. They don't care anymore because, you know, the definition, whatever definition the left is using of racism, seems so opaque to them and to me for that matter, that it basically just amounts to you said something we disagree with, so we're going to call you a racist.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Michael.
That's a dodge.
Pause.
What he's saying.
Pause.
Go ahead.
I understand what you're saying. I don't think it's a significant factor. I don't think that racism is the key to the reactionary nature of a lot of people in the farm states. I think there's certain traditions which come out of their own religious fundamentalism, and indeed there is racism. But among most, I hate to say this, among most, if not all, persons of Caucasian persuasion.
Well, okay, but I think as a political tactic, this use of the word racism is basically going to backfire. You're going to maybe motivate a lot of people on the left to come out and vote by flinging that word around, but you're also going to motivate a lot of people on the right to come out and vote just because they're so fed up with having that word flung at them.
But let me ask you this, Michael. When a largely rural state, let's say take Alabama by way of
just
example.
Just let's take Alabama. You take Alabama. I'm not so sure.
Enacts legislation that makes it much, much harder to vote if you happen to be a person of color. How would we describe that other than as racist?
Well, you know, there's a whole thing there, which is that the word racism has this huge emotional impact, and it has the emotional.
Wait,
impact.
Answer the question. Do you think voter disenfranchisement against people of color is racist or not?
I'm going to answer the question, but I'm answering it the way I want to answer the question. But I am answering the question.
All right.
There's this whole theory of racism now, which goes anything that has quote a disparate impact is therefore racist, and this is basically a dishonest tactic because it takes the huge emotional impact of the word racism that comes from the images that everyone has in their heads of fire hoses and dogs and attacks of peaceful protesters on bridges, and it transfers that and it attempts to transfer that emotional impact to something else.
Well, it doesn't. I don't agree with that. I don't think that's what's going on. I think people are making an analysis and they're talking about it's the impact of, I'm sorry, racism in our culture, a history that goes back to the first slaves.
Well, you know, I don't agree with your perspective there. It seems to me that, like, you know, there's this history that I know. For instance, in New York City, there was a test that you had to pass to become a police sergeant. So they did the test, and not enough black cops passed the police sergeant's test. The Black Police Sergeants Association sued the city and won a case that said, well, you know, the test was racist because, look, all these black cops didn't pass it. And so what the city tried to do was they said, okay, to the black police sergeants, you make up a test that isn't racist and we'll give that test instead. So the black police sergeants hired whoever they hired to put together a non-racist test. They gave that test. Not enough blacks passed that test. And the city got sued again by the black police sergeants for racism because the test that the black police sergeants put together was racist. I mean, at some point, it gets, you know, people.
Well, wait,
thinking,
what are you
know,
saying?
This is wrong.
Michael, do you think the disenfranchisement and vote suppression of people of color in Alabama is racist?
It's possible that it's motivated by racism. But
possible that motivated by racism and a piece of legislation and regulation that disproportionately targets one portion of the population that happens to be not white might be motivated by racism. Michael, I think you need to be a little bit more honest in your analyses. No. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering whether we are transitioning into a security state, which is the opposite of a constitutional state.
I think that's a good observation.
Billionaires are paying millionaires to demonize immigrants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rutger Bregman said that at the Davos conference, and he said, if you're not focused on taxes, you're wasting your time. I have two statistics that I wanted to bring up, and I'm hoping for your comments. One, a statistic from Robert Reich on Facebook, that Boeing received $8.7 billion to stay in Washington while terminating 12,000 workers and receiving a tax bonus of over $1 billion. And the other statistic is from AOC. She was questioning Big Pharma, and she insisted that Big Pharma actually spent $515 billion in stock buybacks. I'm wondering if you know about this. The other question was about international law and whether sanctions are war in another form, whether they're in violation of international law, so that the sanctions that we're imposing on Iran and Venezuela, we actually imposed a complete embargo on August 5th. I mean, thank God Trump is a complete incompetent, so the complete embargo will fail, and we're not going to bring about a change of government. We're not going to bring down the Maduro government. I'm wondering if your comments on the incredible website academia.edu. There are 20 million papers. This could be the people's publisher, and they have all these papers, all these studies, mostly by professors, on Gables. And if you do a search for Gables, you can get a lot of English language.
Do you mean Goebbels? I'm sorry.
Goebbels, I'm sorry, yes. So you can read a lot of English studies on Goebbels and the total war and how, international Jewry was exterminating Germany. Hitler kept repeating that. This is a total lie, a total threat, and this was the reason for the total mobilization of the German people. We are, thanks to the corporate media, of course, people don't have much understanding of history or background.
True. Listen, you're all over the map here, so I want to thank you for the call, and I want to try to address your points one at a time, kind of work my way backwards here. First, you talked about the use of economic embargoes as a tool of statecraft.
Or as war.
You asked, is it kind of war light? Is it war by another name? The answer, unfortunately, is yes. The idea being, that applying a force to economic levers is a less cruel, a less destructive way to compel behavior from a bad acting state, okay? And I'm making this argument more or less in a vacuum. No, this is all fraught with context and corruption and on and on and on. The problem, of course, with embargoes is even if you try to make them very specific, even targeting the economic activities of individuals, there are always people who end up suffering as a result, usually the poor, members of marginalized communities, ethnic minorities, and on and on. So embargoes...
And the working class.
And the working class. Embargoes are a far from perfect instrument in that regard. Also, you asked about Big Pharma and stock buybacks. I don't know about stock buybacks as a strategy specific to Big Pharma, but I do know this, that in recent decades... there have been a slew of large tax cuts that have benefited corporations.
Particularly the Trump ones.
Yes. And usually they're sold to us by somebody saying, hey, this is going to spur investment by business. This is going to create jobs. This is going to make wages rise. That never happens. Instead, what happens quite often is that corporate boards decide to use their their tax cut to buy back shares of stock. And this has two beneficial outcomes from their perspective. One, it brings more shares of stock under the direct control of the board of directors. And secondly, it drives up the prices of those shares of stock, which, let's face it, at the end of the day, is what corporate boards and chief executive officers are legally obligated to do. They have to protect shareholder wealth. That is the fundamental flaw at the heart of corporate capitalism right there. So it doesn't surprise me at all that the pharmaceutical industry, which is historically one of the least ethical corporate actors in the American economy, is carrying out this practice.
You want some fentanyl?
No, I do not. And finally, you asked, have we transitioned from or are we transitioning into a security state as opposed to a constitutional state? I think the jury's still out on that one, although I think if you look around at this moment in time, we are less free than we were during past decades, particularly we're less free now than we were before the September 11th attacks.
Yeah, I think the exception to that would have been the reactionary activities following World War II, where we worked very hard to destroy the American left and the labor movement.
Yeah, and I would add one more caveat to this notion of the security state. If you look at the plight of African Americans in this country, and I don't mean to sound condescending when I use the word plight, we're looking at a progression that started with slavery. It transitioned into Jim Crow. And now we are in the age of mass incarceration, where close to 1 in 3 black men can expect to spend some time behind bars in their lifetime. The United States leads the world in the percentage of its citizens who are behind bars. And this includes nations like China, like Saudi Arabia, totalitarian nations that we would turn our noses up against. So in that regard, in terms of our willingness to imprison our own people, particularly African-American men, but absolutely, we live in a security state.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think we want to get a couple callers in before we disappear. So I want to thank people. 231-8187. Karen, you're next.
Good morning. I really enjoyed hearing that last piece, and I think that was probably Abe, right?
Yeah.
And I... Because what I wanted to bring up was systemic racism. The fellow who called earlier, Michael, he was looking at just the tiny piece at the very end of a whole sequence of causes and effects. And if you've ever spent time amongst African-American folks who don't have money, whose wages are, say, for an African-American woman, say, 60% on the dollar for what a male earns, if you've ever really breathed in that poverty, and if you've ever looked at someone, as I have, working two jobs, trying to raise children on her own, who ultimately died from a stress-induced heart attack, you'd have a better idea of how systemic racism cripples people. And it cripples them not just in the economy, but also in the educational system, and in the medical system, and in the policing system, and wherever you look. Bias. So if I don't know the example the fellow gave, Michael gave, about the African-American cops writing a test. I don't know if it's true or not. But my first impulse would be, let's look at what happened to those guys educationally, you know, who were African-American and trying to pass the test. Let's look at their schools. Were the toilets all blocked up? You know, did they have supplies? Did they even have books or seats? Etc. So I think people are fragile. He sounds like he's whitely fragile, and he can't, for some reason, accept the fact that racism exists in this country. And you really need to go and look and see and experience and make friends with people who are extremely deprived. If you do, you won't have a second thought or a doubt about racism's existence and its horrible consequences for people. And that's it. I'm getting off. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you very much. You're spot on. You're absolutely spot on with that call. With regard to the example Michael was providing us there about the police exam in New York City, essentially what he was doing there was he was throwing up one example which he characterized as a group of people misusing accusations of racism in order to affect an outcome that they wanted. That is not a refutation of systemic racism, as you just very cogently pointed out. He can point to this example as if it somehow invalidates the use of the term racist or invalidates accusations of racism across the board. And that's simply not true.
Well, and he's making it like as if it was some kind of typical thing, which I don't think is so.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, thank you very much for the call. And I would say to Michael, if you're still listening, racism exists. It's a real thing. The sooner you familiarize yourself with it, I think the more the better off
you
will
be. Well, the only alternative is racist. That is to say, well, African Americans just are lazy or stupid or something
right,
like that.
You're right.
And yeah. I don't. It's a stupid idea.
Exactly. Coming up today on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, David Barsamian interviews writer and activist Joe Allen about the challenges faced by Amazon workers. At 10, Flashpoint spends the entire hour remembering the Chicano moratorium and reflecting on the life and times of visionary Chicano journalist Ruben Salazar.
Ah, I actually met him.
Oh, yeah. Interesting guy.
Yeah. Well, I believe murdered by the police.
I think you're right.
I think so.
At 11, Station Studio.
Yes, he was.
Station Studio D-May features the 7th season of Corrib Theater's focus on plays by contemporary Irish playwrights. Maybe they'll write a play about Pence and the Irish Prime Minister.
Aaron Gobra.
And at 11:30, Art Focus Joseph Galavan interviews Mary Weaver Chapin of the Portland Art Museum about Paris 1900. All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported community radio station, KBOO.
Well, yes, and we'll always have Paris.
This just in, thanks to our listener Bryce for tipping us off about this, Boris Johnson just lost his majority in the UK Parliament.
Yay!
There was a defection.
Oh, no.
A conservative
went
over to the Liberal Dems.
Oh, this is such a shame. You mean they might actually have to reconsider a bad Brexit?
They may. Huh. In fact, they will have to reconsider it.
It's such a stupid thing.
No. All right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. This is a lively conversation today.
I'm well, yeah, and it's good. And I think there are many good points being made here. I think that one of the things that has always troubled me is people are probably of good intent trying to find a way to deny the reality of racism in the United States. You really have to go far to argue that.
And Michael, I think, was trying to make a largely semantic point. And that applies insofar as this goes, right? Most people, when they think of racism, they think about somebody being aggressively and maybe even violently discriminatory against people of color.
Yes.
But really, the term means much, much more than that. It describes an entire system that it was designed to privilege one group of people at the expense of others.
Right, and all the evidence is there.
Ranging from economic
stuff to who goes to jail to endless things.
Yep, you don't have to have a swastika tattoo on your head to be a racist. You don't
but
have
that
to
helps.
Wear
that
it does.
Helps.
Yeah. Yeah, it helps the rest of us, you know, recognize you. You don't have to wear a white hood, you know, to be a racist. And you also can be a tacit supporter of a racist system if you don't work to challenge privilege and discrimination when you see it.
I'm glad you said that, because that's really important. People think, oh, well, I don't do anything racist. You're sitting on your hands. Hey, wake up.
Yeah, exactly. You support a guy like Trump because you like what he does for your tax bill, but you don't mind the kicking of brown people at the border, the separation of families. Then you're a tacit supporter of racism.
I agree.
All right.
Well, gee, we're running out of time. I want to thank people a lot. I hope we're doing some good here, and I hope we're not just speaking to the converted. That worries me, because it's KBOO. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's always some of that going on.
Yeah, but right. But we will keep on as long as we can stand each other. Okay, listen, we want to thank you for listening. We want to remind you that KBOO has got the best in public affairs, and that's really true. And actually, what is also really true, some of the finest music broadcasting in the region.
That's right. And we also want to remind you that coming up soon this month is our fall membership drive. If you're not a member of this station,
you really
need to be. And we're going to make that case in the coming weeks. So
yes,
thank you, everybody, for your participation, for your support. And we'll be back at you next week.
Yeah.
But it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8:59. Coming up next after these messages, alternative radio David Barsamian interviews Chicago writer and activist Joe Allen about the challenges faced by Amazon workers.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Festival of Nations on Saturday, September 7th, 11 a.m. at the Extended Home LLC building in Portland. The Festival of Nations celebrates and embraces the diversity of the Division Midway District of Portland. There will be cultural foods, vendors, activities, community services, and more. Again, that's the Festival of Nations on Saturday, September 7th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Extended Home LLC building, 14410 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found on the kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Boys Who Said No, a documentary film screening on Saturday, September 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. During the Vietnam War, draft resistors openly refused military service to draw others to oppose the war. The Boys Who Said No is a documentary film featuring interviews with resistors and historians. Individuals featured include folk singer and activist Joan Baez, resistance leader David Harris, Cleveland Sellers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and Muhammad Ali. Again, that's The Boys Who Said No, screening Saturday, September 14th, at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland, and it's time for David Barsamian on Alternative Radio.